This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million and tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from the Society for Human Resource Management, which also sponsors PBS's CEO Exchange, online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
There's nothing good happening. That was the headline on a commentary from a popular stock market guru today. There's nothing good happening? Oh yeah, says you. Sure, the Dow has suffered its worst percentage loss so far this year than it has since 1978, and yes, the market tanked again today. But if it's good news you're looking for, we found some. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Siemens, from generators that power cities to light bulbs for homes, from factory automation to medical diagnostics. Siemens 70,000 U.S. employees providing solutions for America. And by LendingTree, where you can choose up to four customized loan offers. 1-800-555-TREE. When banks compete, you win.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdahl. Check out some of the headlines, and you'd almost think it wasn't worth getting out of bed on this Wednesday, the 16th of January. Japan's Nikkei stock market index sank to its lowest point in 2 years. London's FTSE dropped to a six-month low. More banks are bleeding red ink. Consumer inflation is up, and U.S. investors are still sweating bullets. Okay, now that we've dispensed with the bad news, remember the wisdom of Monty Python. Always look on the bright side of life. The Federal Reserve is out with its beige book, and there's no mention of a looming recession. Nothing worse than a slower pace of growth. And Marketplace's Jill Barshay turned up more signs that the ship we'll call the USS economy might just be righting itself.
There's no quick way to steer this ship out of peril, but conditions showed a subtle improvement today. Applications for new mortgages jumped 28% last week, so says a report today by the Mortgage Bankers Association. Jay Brinkman is their vice president of research.
It indicates that a lot of people are paying attention to what's going on with interest rates. I think they're looking at some of their adjustable rate mortgages and saying this is a great opportunity to lock into a fixed rate at rates that we have not seen for several years now.
Brinkman says this is the way the cycle is supposed to work. The economy slows, policymakers cut rates, and business starts up again. Mortgage applications surged after the September 11 downturn. That was an early sign that the economy was back on course. But Brinkman says it's too early to make that call again now. There are similar stirrings in the energy sector. David Kirsch is manager of market intelligence at PFC Energy. He says oil spiked above $100 a barrel earlier this month, but today it fell below 90.
Now some of that steam is coming off, as the global economic indicators are coming in far worse than expected.
Cheaper fuel will leave more cash in consumers' pocketbooks, but Kirsch warns oil's still a lot more expensive than a year ago. The weak dollar may help. U.S. exports are up. And MGM Mirage today said more foreign tourists are flocking to its slot machines. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay from Marketplace.
Republican and Democratic leaders huddled on Capitol Hill today and emerged vowing to steer away from the rocks with a bipartisan stimulus package. There's no shortage of proposals in Washington to get the economy back on track. But as much as politicians love to spend money and cut taxes, Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports there's a fight over both.
There are proposals to cut individual income taxes and to give businesses extra investment tax credits. Some want the government to offer struggling families cash rebates or help with heating bills and mortgage payments. Others call for spending on roads and bridges and buildings. In a report weighing the options, the Congressional Budget Office endorsed Democratic proposals to help low-income workers, such as expanding unemployment benefits and food stamps. CBO said the Republican idea of extending President Bush's tax cuts, due to expire in 2011, wouldn't provide any immediate economic stimulus. Asked about that at a Joint Economic Committee hearing today, former Treasury Secretary Lawrence Summers said making those tax cuts permanent would also add to future deficits.
I guess I am very struck by the experience of the 1990s, which I think was pretty powerful in demonstrating that putting deficit problems behind us exerted a very potent positive impact on the economy.
Surpluses, he said, gave individuals and companies confidence. But Pennsylvania Republican Philip English dismissed that in favor of permanent tax cuts as the right stimulus.
I certainly would rather do that rather than threaten tax increases of historic proportions.
One thing both sides agree on is the need for quick action. CBO concludes that waiting too long for stimulus would be worse than no stimulus at all. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
There's word of a new twist to the mortgage default mess. Today's Wall Street Journal is reporting that homelenders are increasingly walking away from fights over delinquent home equity loans. With home values sinking, in many cases it seems it's not worth the cost of foreclosing. Now, I know what you're probably thinking, but as Marketplace's Steve Tripoli reports, that doesn't necessarily mean a free ride for borrowers.
Home equity lenders are only second in line for payment in foreclosures. They're behind the first mortgage lender. So chasing borrowers may not leave enough for them even if they successfully call the loan. Greg McBride is with Bankrate.com.
Second lien positions are riskier, even in good times. However, the easy underwriting guidelines of the past few years are now biting back both borrowers and lenders as home values slump.
When home equity lenders don't foreclose, delinquent homeowners get out from paying, at least for now. But lenders are still leaving liens on these houses, so McBride says owners may not skate free forever.
You can pay them now or pay them later, because the reality of it is the lien stays attached to the home. And that's ultimately something that will be collected if you go to refinance your loan or later sell the home.
This does give pinched borrowers some breathing room. In the meantime, don't expect banks to broadcast these concessions. With $1.1 trillion worth of home equity loans outstanding, they don't want more borrowers getting ideas. I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace.
Wall Street gave in to all the bad news again today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Red Cross is known for being on the scene in times of upheaval and disaster. But the charity has been going through some upheaval of its own in the last several years, and still is, it seems. After 9/11, it faced a barrage of criticism over the way it set aside donations intended for victims of the attack. And since then, its leaders have come and gone through a revolving door, almost a president a year. Now news emerges from the New York Times that the charity faces a $200 million deficit. It may cut as much as 30% of its headquarters workforce and some other jobs around the country. From New York, Ashley Milne-Tite reports fundraising just ain't what it used to be.
The public was furious when it found the Red Cross was funneling some 9/11 donation money to a general fund, a sort of piggy bank for future disasters. Now the Red Cross promises money donated toward a particular disaster goes solely to that cause. Sandra Minuti is with Charity Navigator, which evaluates nonprofits. She says that pledge undercuts the Red Cross's effectiveness.
Because the Red Cross reacted to the donors' concerns and wishes, now they're a little bit hamstrung moving forward. They don't have the flexibility to have money for other disasters that, you know, happen quite regularly in all our communities, fires and other tragedies.
The charity's general fund is now low. Minuti says big disasters galvanize the public to donate. Since Hurricane Katrina, there haven't been any. Stacey Palmer at the Chronicle of Philanthropy says the charity can only partly blame its troubles on a lack of catastrophes. She says the reality is the Red Cross has done a lousy job of fundraising lately.
One of the things a lot of donors are doing is looking online for information, so they need to find ways to reach out to those donors. And the Red Cross has absolutely tried that, but they need to make more concerted efforts to find new ways to attract money.
But to do that, she says, you need a strong leader.
The Red Cross has gone through so many different presidents that it really has been a problem for them that they don't have one spokesman to go out and raise money. Plus, they've had trouble in their fundraising staff. They've had turnover there as well.
She says until the staffing situation settles down, it'll be tough for the charity to raise more funds. And in these lean economic times, staff will need all the persuasive power they can muster. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
The writer's strike is headed into its fourth month, and the damage just keeps coming. We already saw the annual Golden Globes extravaganza called off. The Academy Awards might be next, and even the fall season is in doubt. As we reported yesterday, the studios are cutting loose writers who had been under contract to develop new shows. That's not just a problem for viewers. It could be a killer for the networks and their advertisers. But the sponsors do have other places to turn. As Mary Rose Abraham explains, the living room isn't the only place for TV viewers or advertisers anymore.
These days, when television networks talk about chasing viewers, they mean it literally. Movie theaters, grocery stores, gas stations, and sports events. If you're there, they want to be there.
In our fast-moving digital world, you want the news to move with you. That's why NBC News gives you so many choices. Everywhere you go, there we are.
As TV viewing declines, all the networks are pushing their content into new places. And they'd like advertisers to be there, too. Today, NBC held an elaborate presentation for marketers and media buyers at its New York headquarters. It wants to establish out-of-home media as a separate market, rather than an advertising afterthought.
People are really looking to learn more about the space.
That's Mark French, Senior Vice President and General Manager of NBC Everywhere, which handles out-of-home media.
It's very different than both the TV and the internet world, but at the same time very complementary.
There are an estimated 500,000 advertising screens in retail stores, supermarkets, movie theaters, and other businesses in the U.S. Industry experts say they could bring in more than $2.5 billion ad dollars by 2010. That's a far cry from the $9 billion the big networks collected last year for ads on prime time. But these new ads can go where TV cannot.
It kind of attracts the hard-to-reach viewer.
That's Brad Adgate, a senior vice president at Horizon Media in New York. His firm buys media space and time for its advertiser clients.
This is the last 20 feet or 25 feet of a marketing plan, is having an ad close to a point-of-purchase area, such as in a retail store. That can be very powerful, and marketers are looking at that.
So grocery shoppers, lured by clips from Access Hollywood, can be reminded to grab a carton of orange juice before leaving the store. At more than 500 gas stations around the country, NBC at the pump airs clips from primetime shows and local news mixed with ads.
Sorry to interrupt. I see you're busy getting gas, but what about your oil?
Earlier this week, Big O Tires began running 15-second spots for 80 of its franchises in Southern California. J.C. Cordero is president of Cordero and Davenport Advertising. That's the agency for Big O. He says the company chose the stations because they're near Big O dealerships.
We wanted to talk to this audience about their vehicles at a time when they are interacting with their vehicles.
But many advertisers aren't swayed that digital signs are a good investment. For one thing, it's hard to measure how many people see an ad and whether it's the reason they make a purchase. And for some businesses, it's just not the right fit. Eric Thompson is director of advertising at Mercury Insurance, which sells auto and homeowners insurance policies in 13 states. Thompson says he's sat through many presentations about checkout stands, gas pumps, and cell phones, but he's not convinced they will work to sell insurance.
It's pretty difficult to get a quote via a cell phone. That's a pretty onerous and cumbersome process.
Thompson says it's also difficult to measure the impact of the ads. That may be why digital signs now make up less than 1% of ad volume in the U.S. Again, Horizon Media's Brad Adgate.
Basically, alternative out-of-home media is not television.
At least, not just yet. I'm Mary Rose Abraham for Marketplace.
Coming up, one style does not fit all in the big and tall section.
What we call Sopranos wear, the standard three vertical stripes. You know, there's a reason why that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. But first, let's do the numbers. A sluggish technology sector sent stocks lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed down 34 points, or 0.25%, to close at 12,466. The NASDAQ slipped 23 points, or 0.9%, to finish at 2,394. The S&P 500 lost 7 points, or 0.5%, to end at 1,373. Intel led the market downward as its stock tumbled more than 12% on news that first quarter sales wouldn't meet expectations. Financials were an unexpected bright spot. J.P. Morgan shares were up 5.75% after the financial giant's earnings topped analyst estimates. Never mind its subprime losses. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.74%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Pandemic flu is a real threat, but there are steps you can take to prepare. More information at takethelead.pandemicflu.gov. Every day's Marketplace is put together the day of. If you want to get the show info as it's being created, sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It also includes upcoming special projects on the show. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on housing starts for December. Experts on wildlife protection and oil drilling testify before the House Select Committee on Energy Independence and Global Warming. They'll discuss dangers to the polar bear population in Alaska. And the party is underway in Park City, Utah. The annual Sundance Film Festival opens tomorrow. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. And now let's do some more numbers. John McCain is up 1.33% heading into the South Carolina primary, and shares in the leading Democrats are trading flat. No, the last we checked, GOP was not a ticker symbol on the New York Stock Exchange, and Democrats weren't trading on the NASDAQ. Those numbers are from Intrade's political futures market. But you can't necessarily take them to the bank. Commentator Dan Dresner says that as indicators go, political futures markets have a mixed record.
Psst. Want to make some extra money and contribute to the public good? I've got a plan. Let's play the political prediction markets. Websites like the Iowa Electronic Market, or Intrade, have been the trendy oracle in recent election cycles among pundits in the know. Participants in these markets trade in the likelihood of a particular candidate winning the nomination. The market price for each candidate essentially represents that person's probability of winning the nomination. If one believes in efficient markets, then prediction market prices represent the best forecast of the future. Wharton School professor Justin Wolfers recently argued in the Wall Street Journal that prediction markets outperform contemporaneous polls on a consistent basis. As he put it, markets are forward-looking, while polls are backwards-looking. The problem is that it's not at all clear whether prediction markets are efficient. Prediction markets have gotten past elections wrong. On election day in 2004, the Iowa Electronic Market priced John Kerry as the likely winner. On election day in 2006, Intrade put an 85% probability on the Republicans holding the Senate. Ironically, when Wolfers wrote his column a few weeks ago, the prediction markets priced Hillary Clinton as the likely Democratic nominee. Since then, the Intrade share price for Clinton dropped by 40 points after Iowa, before recovering its value after New Hampshire. In the future, as prediction markets become more mainstream, they will expand in size and scope, and their informational efficiency might improve. And to be clear, political prediction markets are far from useless. Think of them as representing the purest, most distilled snapshot of the conventional wisdom's expectations of the upcoming election. So back to us making some money. Political science research suggests that, in the past, a sophisticated analysis of polling could outperform the market. The problem, even for savvy and sophisticated public radio listeners, is that in such a wide-open election year, with polls fluctuating wildly from day to day, there is not a lot of sophisticated analysis to go around. Writing about Hollywood, screenwriter William Goldman famously said, "Nobody knows anything." Remember that line when looking for your next political oracle.
Dan Dresner is a professor of international politics at Tufts University. His most recent book is called All Politics is Global. Are the presidential candidates addressing your concerns? Tell us. Just go to marketplace.org and click on Election 2008. It seems a lot of us are growing more concerned about a recession. A Reuters Zogby survey out today indicates voter malaise is beginning to color views on the presidential election, much the way it did back in 1992 when Bill Clinton's campaign focus was, "It's the economy, stupid." New York Times economics columnist David Leonhardt writes today that candidates would be well advised to pay attention to that advice this time around, especially if they want to connect with the American middle class. Mr. Leonhardt, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
You argue in your column today that the middle class is struggling more than ever before. How so?
It's a little bit tricky because some of this has to do with expectations. In many ways, the middle class is better off than it has ever been. But we used to have pretty consistently increases in living standards year to year. People in the middle class could expect that they would be able to buy more this year than they could last year. And those gains have really slowed to a crawl. In the current expansion, which began in 2001, they've essentially slowed to nothing at all. And that's very frustrating for a lot of obvious reasons. It's people feel like they want to be moving ahead, and yet they often feel like they're staying in one place.
Deja vu here. Why does this sound so much to me like 1992?
Because in many ways it is like 1992. When I look at the polls, when they ask people, how do you feel about the state of the economy, we're really very similar. If anything, the mood is a little bit worse going into this time. So I think the parallels to 1992, while not quite exact, because the timing is a little different with the election, because there isn't an incumbent president, I think the parallels are really quite strong.
We heard today that Democrats and Republicans on Capitol Hill have agreed to come up with a bipartisan stimulus package to deal with the recession. Is that going to be enough to satisfy the middle class when it comes to this problem?
Well, there's a short-term problem and a long-term problem here. Short-term, I think a stimulus is really a good idea. But no short-term stimulus package is going to solve these longer-term issues. These issues with middle-class pay gains that we're talking about don't involve any one president. They don't even involve any one decade. They stretch way back to the mid-1970s. I think the most important thing to do is get this stimulus package passed, get beyond it, and then hopefully return the discussion to some of the more serious longer-term issues.
And so what do you see as the possible long-term fixes here?
Well, I think the first long-term fix is education. And I think the Republicans tend to be more right on this than the Democrats. The Democrats are very closely aligned with the teachers' unions, which means they tend to see education much more as a jobs program for very large number of middle-class people, teachers and their families. In some ways, that's understandable. The Republicans are much more willing to buck the unions, and so they're much more open to ideas like school choice. So what I'd love to see is some sort of solution in which we have the Democrats' desire to bring the amount of resources they want to bring to education combined with the Republicans' desire to make it more flexible. Beyond that, I think you have to look at health care, which is a huge source of anxiety because people worry that if they lose their jobs, they'll lose their health care, and they're often right. And then finally, there's the tax code. There's no getting around the fact that not only have the rich gotten much bigger pay increases than the middle class, but their tax rates have also fallen a lot more over the last couple decades. So middle class people not only haven't gotten big tax cuts, they've gotten small tax cuts, they've gotten very small pay increases. So I think if you're looking at this from a long-term perspective, making the tax code more progressive than it is today probably needs to be part of the solution.
David Leonhardt is economics columnist for the New York Times. Appreciate your insights.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Here's a staggering figure. The percentage of American adults who are overweight, 66%. Think about that. Fully two-thirds of us are in the market for bigger everything. In menswear alone, the big and tall market is worth $5 billion and, shall we say, growing every day. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins takes a look at a company that's trying to tackle this big market through some unlikely characters.
Dave Friedman is your average Californian. He's got a house, a baby, a dog named Moxie. Oh, and one more thing. He's put on a few pounds since college. For guys like him, stores sell Hawaiian shirts, T-shirts that could double as rain tarps, and
what we call Sopranos wear, the standard three vertical stripes. You know, there's a reason why that makes sense, because vertical stripes do tend to be a little slimming. But the problem is the style hasn't changed since somebody figured that out 40 years ago.
So Friedman teamed up with a designer to start his own line of clothing, Colossal. And for production, they contract manufacturer and retailer American Apparel. Friedman says he likes American Apparel's cachet as a trendy upstart. And that helps as he's trying to find buyers for his line. Colossal has already landed a deal with the National Football League alumni. Still, building buzz in a niche market is tough.
Typically, big guys don't necessarily hang out together. They're not easy to target, and you need people who congregate. And that's when it occurred to us, you know what? Gay big men do.
May I introduce the Bears?
Okay, guys, say grrr.
The Bears are a subset of the gay community known for their flannel, their scruffy beards, and the size of their waistlines. Steve O'Harris is doing a photo shoot for a Bears Life magazine.
Okay, here we go. Big smiles.
The storyline for this centerfold, just three bears wearing Colossal, having breakfast.
Being comfortable enough to be in your underwear.
Don't get too excited. A Bear's Life is only slightly more risque than O Magazine.
I call it Oprah with fur.
Steve O'Harris is also the publisher of A Bear's Life. Colossal is making the magazine a cornerstone of its marketing strategy. It's taken out ads, and images from today's shoot will appear as a spread in the March issue. But most advertisers have been slow to discover the 1.4 million bears in America.
We're not looked at necessarily as being big purchasers.
Bill Devine is a bear in Minneapolis. He says he sometimes has trouble finding clothes that flatter a belly he calls rotund.
After a while, you get to the point where you just don't want to go shopping. You'd literally go in going, okay, this will fit, this will fit, I don't care.
Analysts say retailers have been banking for too long on that I don't care attitude. Some clothing labels have deliberately strayed from producing bigger sizes, preferring only to have skinny people wear their clothes.
It's frustrating. It's frustrating to be kind of overlooked as a market because in regards to, I guess, our disposable income, I would think that we would have just as much of it.
And they do. Bears have an average household income of $90,000 a year. And Devine says they're willing to pay more for quality. Marshall Cohen, a marketing analyst with the NPD Group, says as Americans expand, retailers ought to start thinking big. He says the Bears are a good place to start.
The most vocal consumer is the gay community within the male apparel industry.
In other words, Bears talk, and Colossal hopes they keep on talking. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, remember earlier this week when we told you that American Idol was going to save a season of television crippled by the screenwriters' strike? The people listless from so many Law & Order reruns would turn to the reality show as a bright spark of original content? Well, preliminary numbers seem to indicate something less sparkling. Nielsen is reporting that ratings are down 11% from last year. American Idol is still the most watched non-sports show on TV, but the ratings seem to imply that 4.2 million people might just have found something better to do with themselves. possibly the Marketplace podcast. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 34 points, 0.25%. The NASDAQ dropped 23 points, 0.9%. And the S&P 500 slumped 7 points, 0.5%. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Nicole Bernoni, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineer the program for us. Next time on Marketplace, Portland's bike culture takes to the streets with new tactics and tricks.
If you see a car, you say, car, car.
3, 2, 1, 3, 4.
I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.